No pints for St. Pat's, so says the lead headline on the Irish Daily Mirror. The paper reports that people have been urged by the Deputy Chief Medical Officer not to buy takeaway beer and cans or meet up with pals to celebrate the national holiday tomorrow. The Irish Daily Mail, of a similar mind, carries the warning by the Deputy CMO and NPHET that protests and celebrations planned for St. Patrick's Day and Easter could send COVID cases surging again. The Irish Independent headline speaks of fears of a St. Patrick's Day surge. The paper reports that Gardaí are planning a series of checkpoints on suburban roads to stop protesters coming into Dublin tomorrow, in a bid to quell the latest anti-lockdown protest. They will be at railway stations, bus and Lewis stops, a massive operation, the paper says, with more than 200 Gardaí deployed in the city centre itself. The Irish Examiner editorial writer says it is an irony beyond even Miles na gCoileán that this will be one of the very few countries unable to mark St. Patrick's Day in an Irish pub. The Independent notes that St. Patrick's Day celebrations are largely taking place online and wonders if the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, will use smokeless fuel for his virtual fireside chat with the US President Joe Biden. Whatever about that, the writer says it is consoling to know that Irish-American roots were never deeper or on such a firm footing. The Deputy CMO, Dr. Ronan Glynn, again, provides the Examiner's lead story with his warning of a fourth wave of COVID-19. He said, "We are seeing this play out across Europe, with many countries now experiencing pressure on their hospital and critical care capacities. We must not let this happen here." The Irish Times reports that it has emerged that the first round of COVID-19 vaccinations for thousands of vulnerable patients will not be completed until well into April, as a result of the decision to suspend use of the AstraZeneca vaccine. That assessment of the date comes from Dr. Colm Henry, HSE Chief Clinical Officer. And vaccines provide the main story for the Irish News. The Northern Ireland Health Minister, Robin Swan, is quoted as having said yesterday that people in the north cannot pick and choose which COVID vaccine they get. He urged people to continue to come forward for their vaccination. In other news, The Independent has a picture of Muireann Houlihan, aged 5, enjoying a rare sighting of a walrus on Valentia Island, which you may have heard about yesterday on the programme. The photograph was taken by her father, Alan. The paper quotes an ecologist, Don Cotton, as saying, "To see one sitting out on the rocks, it's incredible."
The European Medicines Agency will review safety information on the AstraZeneca vaccine later today. Around 30,000 people here have had their vaccine appointments postponed after health authorities here and in several countries across Europe suspended the use of the vaccine because of concerns over unusual blood clotting cases in Norway. There have been no further deaths from the virus reported in the Republic in the last 2 days. One death was reported in the north yesterday, but the spread of the disease has barely changed in recent days. Here's Professor Philip Nolan, Chair of NPHET's Modelling Advisory Group, at the latest health briefing.
If we compare the last 2 weeks, so we were declining at 40% per week, then 20% per week on average for about 5 or 6 weeks. But then looking back at last week compared with the preceding week, 3,541 cases reported last week, 3,634 in the preceding week, a decrease of only 3%. So that sense that we had towards the end of last week, that the decline in case numbers that we had been seeing for 4 weeks had stopped declining, that's pretty much reinforced by the data.
That's Professor Philip Nolan. Later in the programme, we'll hear from Dublin-based GP Dr. Ray Wally, who says that the stubborn spread of the disease now is being driven by a strain of the virus that's very easy to catch.
I'm aware of one family who visited a family member who is dying in a hospital from COVID, and all the family have developed COVID as a result. We need to be cognizant that this is a disease that has high morbidity and high mortality. I think we need to focus on, again, people wearing a mask, keeping their social distance, washing their hands, getting the basics right, because this disease we had managed greatly to date. Figures were coming down, and we need to refocus on getting the basics right again.
Dr. Ray Whalley, where our health correspondent Fergal Bowers was at that briefing, and he's with us now. Morning again, Fergal. The number of people catching the virus and the number going to hospital sick from the virus has barely changed in recent days. Why?
Yes, the number of people in hospital with COVID-19, it does remain high, including those in intensive care units. Last night, 360 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in hospital, and of those, 85 in intensive care units. So a slight increase in the numbers in hospital, very small reduction in the numbers in ICU, but they're not changing a lot. And obviously, NPHET has been expressing concern about St. Patrick's Day and the Easter coming up and the weather getting better. And it has warned that while vaccines will have a very significant positive impact on COVID-19 in time, they say it won't stop a further wave of the disease over the coming weeks. Now, it's important to say NPHET says it's not saying there will be a fourth wave, but that cases have plateaued, and that's a concern. And with cases static, if not increasing actually, 550 cases a day on average.
Now, tomorrow, as you said, is St. Patrick's Day. Easter isn't too far away, and there were concerns expressed that both could lead to more people gathering. Here's the Deputy CMO, Dr. Ronan Glynn.
We still have a level of people in hospital that's equivalent to the peak last November. We still have double the people in critical care that we had last autumn. So we are by no means out of the woods on this. We have 3 weeks to go until measures are due to be looked at again or to be changed again. And what we're asking people, and it's very difficult, we've got St. Patrick's Day coming up in 2 days' time. We've got Easter coming up. The weather's getting better. All of this encourages us to drop our guard. It encourages us to mix with other people. If we do that over the next 3 weeks, given the levels of disease in the community, we will see a significant deterioration, and none of us want to see that.
Dr. Ronan Glynn. Fergal, what more was said about tomorrow and plans for cans and protests?
Well, Dr. Glynn was saying that people shouldn't be meeting up over the next few days, so that they shouldn't congregate in other households, but if they are, not to meet inside, and also, you know, don't be congregating with many households. He also asked people not to attend protests or demonstrations, and there may be some tomorrow. And, you know, he said he appreciated some people are very passionate about certain issues, but if they attend demonstrations, they would be breaching public health advice, placing their health and the health of others and other people's lives perhaps at risk, because, you know, the level of the disease is still very, very high. And the bottom line is that the advice remains to stay at home.
There were several questions yesterday about children and the virus, especially with many more children back at school and mixing again. Tell us more.
Well, NPHET says it's seeing more cases in older children and young adults. And so it's seen a rise in cases, particularly in those aged 19 to 24, but also those aged, you know, 13 to 18, 5 to 12. It's seeing most of these cases, it says, in the community and in households. They say it's not school-related. Professor Philip Nolan said very few of the cases in young people are being seen in the school setting at this point in time.
Vaccines, Fergal. Are health authorities here expecting that they'll be free to use AstraZeneca again next week?
Well, that seems to be the feeling from last night's meeting. The European Medicines Agency, of course, the Safety Committee meets today, and then there's an extraordinary meeting of the EMA on Thursday. And at NPHET last night, the expectation was that the pause on the AstraZeneca vaccine will be short-lived. And if the green light comes through on Thursday, well, what happens then, the sequencing is that the National Immunisation Advisory Committee would meet quickly. They would then, in writing, advise the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, who in turn would advise the government, and then the HSC could hopefully resume plans to vaccinate those who've had a delay. So the hope is the delay could be for a number of days, and perhaps you could see AstraZeneca being used again next week. It's important to say that and none of this affects those people aged 70 years and older, because GPs are using the mRNA vaccines for that group, so they shouldn't worry. And it has no impact on the second dose of AstraZeneca, because that's given 12 weeks after the first, and we haven't hit that 12-week period yet.
And yet, Fergal, many GPs were busy yesterday cancelling appointments and clinics to vaccinate older people with the other vaccines. Why?
Well, Dr. Ray Wally, who you mentioned there, Dublin GP, who's on the COVID-19 GP liaison committee, you know, he said no GP wants to have to cancel a clinic, but, you know, vaccination, delivery of vaccination is based on supply. And he did say there is a limitation of supply to around 100 GP practices this week out of 1,300 practices. Now, at the moment, GPs are concentrating on the vaccination programme for the those aged 70 and older. And the first cycle of this vaccine programme ended last week with 99% of 85s having received their vaccination, according to Dr. Wally. And he says this, the first round of the second dose for those aged 85 and older starts this week. That's going to take about 4 weeks in total. Okay. So we're told that the overall programme for the over 70s is on target to be completed by mid-May.
Fergal Barris, thank you. We'll speak to Dr. Ray Wally a little later in the programme. Almost 20 past seven.
Postmasters say there will be a wave of post office closures unless a payment is continued beyond its scheduled cut-off point in June. The transformation payment was introduced by Unpost back in 2018. Representatives from the Irish Postmasters Union are due before the Oireachtas Committee on Transport and Communications later today. Ned O'Hara is the General Secretary of the IPU and he's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. How did this payment come about? And on average, how much is it worth?
The payment came about because postmasters, as we know, the post office network has been subject to review and has been in trouble for the last number of years. We engaged with the Bobby Kerr Group in 2016 to 2018 and nothing was really happening. We knew the network was in grave danger, so we came to an agreement with Unpost that they would support the network as we transitioned itself to commercial rates. And they also brought in a protocol for the size of the network. That agreement foresaw or was dependent on new services promised by the government for generations that they would be introduced over the next 2 or 3 years. The system or the situation will be reviewed in 2020 to see if those new services had been introduced, and they haven't. And we arrived at the situation that we're currently at. I think in relation to the network, everybody knows it's a service that's valued and needed. And every TD and government minister that we meet says it's a service that's valued and needed. And what we really want now is somebody with a political backbone to make a decision for this investment, which has been on the back of a report by Grant Thornton produced last year, which was an independent review of the network, arguably which should have been done by the department rather than by postmasters. But nevertheless, that report said that without an investment of 17 million, by the end of June this year, there would be unrestrained closures. And what we're looking for is somebody to make that decision before the post office network declines and disappears, like lots of other good things in this country. We are relevant, particularly over the last 12 months when we were an essential service during COVID. We do carry out 30 million DSP transactions every year, and we serve 1.3 million people to whom we are very important. The other point we would make in relation to the investment is, compared to the money that's been put into the banks, 17 million with a return which Grant Thornton say will give between 334 million and 776 million, compared to the money that's been put into the banks, it is peanuts. And I think it was St. Matthew said, the gnats and camels, that analogy, the strain of gnats and swallow camels. So we want somebody with the political backbone to make a decision and put in a plan for the normal business cycle, subject to review every two years or every 3 years, okay, to take the uncertainty away for the people that we serve.
All right. So just to be clear about this, what you're looking for here is money from the government rather than from Unpost, because Unpost says it's already spent 50 million euro. It says it's introduced new financial services. It says it's offered training to postmasters. So is it really the government you're looking to?
What we're really looking for, Rachel, is the services that people say that they want to be made available in the post office. Like we, in the absence of those services, the network is going to go to the wall. What we are looking for is, there's a range of services that have been identified, and what we are looking for is the post office to be the solution for those services all around Ireland, urban and rural. And all we need is the decision to make in principle. We're not looking for exclusivity in relation to services like motor tax, for instance. All we are saying is we should have the option so that if I want to tax my car, my options are online or go into town to the Dublin City Council office, get the bus into town, pass the post office on my way to town, and I could, if I had the choice, decide to pay my car tax in the post office. I haven't got that option.
Okay.
So all we're asking for is the options be made available to people.
Given, though, that the Ulster Bank is leaving, as we know, and that Bank of Ireland is closing branches all over the country, are there not opportunities there? I mean, are opportunities not on the way anyway?
Yes, there are opportunities on the way. But again, referring back to Graham Thornton, that even if all those opportunities were to happen, they're not going to happen before the end of June this year. And we recognise that the Bank of Ireland transactions will have benefit for the post office network. But our concern is, will there be a post office network there left to take advantage of those services?
The Minister of State, Hildegard Nocton, she set up a committee to examine ways of directing more business towards the post office network. Presumably that's something you'd welcome.
Yeah, we would welcome. But the issue with that is it's due to report at the end of July. Our people, our members are making decisions now in relation to their futures. They can't wait until the end of July. And I don't mean to be sceptical or cynical in relation to cross departmental groups, but like a report expected at the end of July, I don't really expect that to happen. I expect that to happen September, October. And in the meantime, postmasters will be left with it on the vine.
All right. Well, we'll see how you get on at that committee later on today. Ned O'Hara, General Secretary of the Irish Postmasters Union, thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland, 7:25.
The Taoiseach Micheál Martin will today continue his programme of virtual US events in the run-up to St Patrick's Day. He'll attend online roundtable discussions with business leaders this afternoon ahead of his virtual meeting with US President Joe Biden tomorrow. President Biden, meanwhile, is today embarking on the first leg of a tour of the US to promote his massive $1.9 trillion coronavirus rescue package. Our correspondent in Washington is Brian O'Donovan.
Well, today's events very much focused on business and economic ties between the US and Ireland. The Taoiseach Micheál Martin will attend virtual roundtable discussions hosted by the US Chamber of Commerce, Enterprise Ireland, the IDA. He'll speak with senior executives, and it's all about highlighting the fact that it's a two-way trade and investment relationship. It's not just about the big American companies setting up in Ireland. There are also 110,000 people employed in the US by 900 Irish-owned companies. Yesterday, the Taoiseach addressed a number of virtual US events, including delivering an address to the Washington-based Brookings Institution. Now, it was interesting that at the end of that address, they opened it to questions, and lots of the questions were about the issue of Irish unity and if there would be a border poll. Last week, of course, here in the US, the Friends of Sinn Féin ran this big, high-profile ad campaign calling for a united Ireland. Now, on this, Micheál Martin pushed back against the idea, and he said that discussions that took place around Irish unity immediately after Brexit were a mistake, and that it put people back into the trenches too early. He said his preference was to develop a shared dialogue, and that there would not be a referendum on Irish unity in the lifetime of this government. In his address to the Brookings Institution yesterday, he also made reference to that recent unilateral action we saw being taken by the UK on the Brexit withdrawal agreement.
The withdrawal agreement contains within it mechanisms specifically designed to deal with issues that arise, a joint committee and specialised committees. That is where teething problems should be worked through so that we can find common solutions. Unilateral action to disapply or not to implement aspects of the protocol does nothing but corrode trust, the only basis on which sustainable long-term solutions can be found. It exacerbates uncertainty and instability, two things Northern Ireland can well do without.
The big day, of course, is tomorrow, Brian, when the Taoiseach has a virtual meeting with the US President Joe Biden. What will the day's events look like, and what will the two leaders discuss?
Well, I think, Gavin, the big idea tomorrow is to replicate as closely as possible what a traditional Taoiseach's visit to Washington would look like under normal circumstances. And you're going to try and have the same set-piece events just done in a virtual format. There'll be a meeting with the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, members of Congress. There'll be talks with the Vice President, Kamala Harris. And then, yes, the big event is the virtual meeting with President Joe Biden. An actual physical Shamrock Bowl has already been delivered to the White House. We understand it'll be put on the table next to Joe Joe Biden for the duration of their hour-long meeting, which takes place tomorrow. Now, Micheál Martin has been doing several interviews with US TV networks in the run-up to tomorrow's meeting, and one of the big questions he's being asked all the time is, of course, on the issue of COVID-19 vaccines. And will he ask Joe Biden for additional vaccine supply, given that we have this massive stockpile of vaccines here in the US, whereas Europe is struggling to get their hands on supply? Now, over the weekend, the Taoiseach told CBS News that he wasn't aware of too many countries who were giving away their vaccine supplies. He did say, however, that he will be discussing the whole issue of COVID-19 vaccines with Joe Biden when he meets him. Of course, we can expect Brexit, the peace process, also to be very high up on that agenda, particularly in light of yesterday's legal action taken by the EU against the UK over this unilateral action on the Northern Ireland Protocol. The White House Press Secretary, Jen Psaki, was asked about this issue yesterday at her daily briefing.
We continue to encourage both the European Union and the UK government to prioritise pragmatic solutions to safeguard and advance the hard-won peace in Northern Ireland. We would, of course, encourage you to speak to those governments directly about any legal actions. President Biden has been unequivocal in his support for the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. This agreement has been the bedrock of peace, stability, and prosperity for all the people of Northern Ireland. And we also welcome cooperation between our British and Irish counterparts on the Northern Irish Protocol.
Now, Brian, President Biden will be celebrating St. Patrick's Day tomorrow, but today he's celebrating the passage of his massive coronavirus rescue plan, and he's going on the road to promote it.
That's right, yeah, Gavin. Joe Biden, the First Lady Jill Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and her husband Doug are all fanning out across the country this week to spread the word about Joe Biden's massive $1.9 trillion coronavirus rescue plan. It means stimulus payments for taxpayers, expanded unemployment benefits, as well as funding for vaccine rollout and the reopening of schools. Joe Biden will visit small businesses today in Pennsylvania to highlight how they will benefit from the package. And the whole idea of this, I think, is there's a sense among many Democrats that after the last big recession back in 2008, the Obama administration had this huge $800 billion rescue package. And there's a feeling among Democrats that they didn't get enough credit for it at the time. And they didn't get the political capital. They didn't get the bounce from it because they went on to lose control of the House of Representatives to Republicans in 2010. They do not want that to happen again. So there's a real sense that they need to push this message, go on the road and highlight the extent of this package. Republicans, not particularly happy with this package. Not one of them voted for the bill when it was in Congress. They say it is far, far too expensive and it contains too much money for Democratic pet projects, they say, that have nothing to do with the pandemic.
And that's our correspondent, Brian O'Donovan, in Washington. 7:31.
On the occasion of your National Day, I would like to convey to Your Excellency my congratulations, together with my best wishes to the people of Ireland. That's the message in a letter to the President, Michael D. Higgins, from Queen Elizabeth of the United Kingdom, as reported in the Irish Independent. She signed off the letter with Lá Éile Pádraig Sona Díobh Galair. But it's no pints for St. Pat's. That's according to the lead headline on the Irish Daily Mirror. The paper reports that people have been urged by the Deputy Chief Medical Officer not to buy takeaway beer and cans or meet up with pals to celebrate the national holiday tomorrow. The Irish Daily Mail, of a similar mind, carries the warning by the Deputy CMO and NPHET that protests and celebrations planned for St. Patrick's Day and Easter could send COVID cases surging again. The Independent lead headline speaks of fears of a St. Patrick's Day surge. The paper reports that Gardaí are planning a series of checkpoints on suburban roads to stop protesters coming into Dublin tomorrow.
Brian Finn is back with the business news.
Gavin, thank you. The introduction of a new immigration regime in the UK in January, which ends freedom of movement, has resulted in a shift in job-seeking patterns from EU candidates, and it's beginning to come through in the numbers here. Jack Kennedy is an economist with the online recruitment firm Indeed, and he's been doing some research into this. What exactly are you seeing, Jack?
Yeah, good morning, Brian. So we looked at cross-border interest in jobs on Indeed Ireland, which we measure by the share of clicks from job seekers located in the rest of the EU. We found that in the first 2 months of this year, Ireland retained its popularity with EU job seekers, despite travel restrictions in Ireland having a relatively stringent lockdown. At the same time, we saw the UK was seeing a decline in interest of about 28% from EU job seekers, suggesting a potential shift from working in the UK post-Brexit. And we actually saw that Ireland saw increased interest in a number of sectors where the UK is seeing flat or declining interests, so particularly media and communications jobs. We saw that interest from EU job seekers rose by about 3.5 percentage points compared with the same period a year ago.
And presumably that includes IT jobs, of which we appear to have plenty here.
It does include IT jobs. It also includes a number of social media and digital roles, like content moderators and digital designers. We also saw increased interest in jobs like linguists, archivists and psychologists, and also sectors like beauty and wellness, the arts, sports, childcare and food service.
And you mentioned the pandemic, Jack, and it's probably difficult to get a true picture of the landscape at the moment. Are people able to come here to take up jobs, or are they working remotely? And indeed, is that why we're seeing such interest in IT, given that people can work remotely in that area?
Yeah, it does vary a lot by sector. Certainly, IT remote working prevalence is a lot higher, but there are a lot of sort of consumer-facing, face-to-face services that job seekers. It's more difficult to travel, but there is still clearly interest from job seekers in doing so. And we're really seeing, I think, signs of a potential kind of Brexit impact, shifting job seeker interest, particularly from candidates that may be interested in working in an English-speaking country. They're finding it harder to come to the UK now, and they're perhaps looking increasingly at Ireland as an alternative.
And what is the overall market like in the UK? Has it tightened considerably with the restriction of movement?
So with the UK, we've seen that it's the volume of job postings is actually down more than in Ireland. So the UK market has taken a bigger hit, and it's also had a slower recovery. We are seeing that job seekers are finding it more difficult. Obviously, freedom of movement from the EU has ended, and job seekers are finding it more difficult to find permission to work in a number of sectors now. We are seeing more interest from outside the EU, particularly at the higher paid end of the labour market, where the focus on the UK's immigration regime is now more focused. But we are seeing at the lower paid end sort of concerns around skill shortages in areas like social care and construction kind of increasingly coming to the fore.
And are they likely to skim the cream of the crop in the UK with these new skills and salary threshold? It arguably gives them an elitist edge when it comes to searching for candidates for particular roles.
We are hearing that employers are finding it easier to tap into non-EU sources. Particularly one area is Hong Kong. The UK government offered citizenship to several million Hong Kongers last year, and we are seeing increased interest in higher paid jobs in sectors like finance, tech and engineering in particular from highly skilled candidates from Hong Kong. So there are a few silver linings from the UK side as well.
Jack Kennedy, economist with Indeed, thank you very much. Indeed, more business news at 8:30.
Transcripts of thousands of letters sent home by Irish emigrants are to be digitised and made available on an online database. The collection of letters from America covers a period of more than 250 years. It was gathered by a US academic who's donated his archive to NUI Galway. Our Western correspondent Pat McGrath reports.
Walla Walla, November 27th, 1879. Dear brother, my trials of life are too innumerable to think of telling you all.
In a temperature-controlled room in the basement of the Hardiman Library at NUI Galway, the contents of 50 boxes are being opened and examined. Each contains fascinating records detailing the experiences of Irish people in America.
Every single corner of the United States men and women, writing back to every part of Ireland, north, south, east and west. It is absolutely extraordinary.
And thousands are sailing to America.
The material runs from the late 1600s to the mid-1950s, collected by Professor Kirby Miller from the University of Missouri over five decades. It gives an amazing insight into how people made their way in a place far, far from home.
Dear sister, I hope you will excuse me for not writing sooner. I enclose the sum of 10 shillings for you and Sarah.
Sometimes the earlier letters are just filled with enormous amounts of information on an incredible range of topics. For many of the later letters, they're much shorter, but sometimes you'll just get incredible gems of insights and information that will just blow you away.
Original letters were borrowed from families all over the country, photocopied and transcribed before being returned to their owners.
You have to understand the correspondence changes really dramatically between, say, the early 19th century and the late 19th century. It changes because the social, economic, class, religious, regional backgrounds of the emigrants change enormously during that period. But it also changes because of the very nature of transatlantic correspondence. In the early 19th century, people wrote huge letters, but they only wrote one a year. And half of them at least never arrived. Whereas in the late 19th, early 20th century, you have the introduction of what was called the penny post. And the overwhelming majority of letters arrived, but they tended to be very short because they had to be under a certain weight so that they could qualify for such a low rate of postage.
Cascade, Iowa, October 10th, 1879. Dear nephew, I'm sorry to hear and to see by our daily papers the destitution that is likely to prevail in Ireland on account of the wet season.
Work on the digitization project will commence in the coming weeks. Brendan MacSwivna of Ochadov na Holskoliocht Gaeilge explains the significance of the collection.
You're looking at letters that were sent by ordinary Irish people who went to America. They didn't find a place where the streets were lined with gold. You know, they had hard, lonely lives. And that's what is in this correspondence. It illuminates the experience of our people who left.
There's an enormous amount of sense of loss, of loneliness, and of exile.
I, like yourselves, have had troubles in the death of one of my sons, Charles, a fine, promising boy of 14 years of age.
Even the quickest glance at these letters reveals the importance with which they were treated. Professor Dan Carey from the Moore Institute at NUI Galway has been struck by the manner in which correspondence was treasured through the generations.
Yeah, these are emotional documents. They're emotional records of loss and of reconnection. I think that's what letters do. That was the principal form of communication that people had. Some of these come from personal collections and some come from archives. So we have the north of Ireland, we have the west of Ireland, we have really quite a distribution. And then when you get to the US itself, there are plenty of letters from Pennsylvania, for example, but as far afield as Iowa, some very obscure small towns and places that people found their way to. So partly these are records of movement and of emigration as a form of mobility.
And there are an awful lot of emigrant letters out there in the country. And in time, they can be added to our database. And it'll be an extraordinary resource. So this is a gift to the National University of Ireland, Galway. But it's also a gift to the country. And it is a gift to our posterity in that it engages us with the issue of migration, which is going to be a defining issue of the 21st century.
Brendan MacSwivna from NUI Galway, ending that report from our correspondent Pat McGrath.
Three out of every four major serious injuries to children are avoidable. That's according to a report which examined over 1,300 cases of major trauma to children over 6 years in hospitals across the country. The audit also found that low falls, road traffic collisions and burns account for almost three quarters of cases, that most trauma happens at home to boys in the afternoon and in the summer. Professor Conor Deasy is clinical lead for the major trauma audit at the National Office of Clinical Audit. Professor Deasy, good morning. Thanks for taking our call today.
Good morning.
Why was this study carried out and what more was found?
So look, this is actually a very important report that we're releasing this morning. And it's the first report that comprehensively describes major trauma in children. So we at the National Office of Clinical Audit have looked at the clinical stories of 1,382 children who have sustained life-threatening or life-changing injuries between 2014 and 2019. So these are children who were brought into the 26 hospitals in Ireland that are presently receiving children who have sustained major trauma. And what we found is that 57% needed to be transferred on from that initial hospital to another hospital for definitive treatment. We also found that parents often don't ring 112 or 999 and understandably just grab the child direct and go directly to whatever site has got emergency department written over the door. In fact, 41% were brought by their parent directly to the nearest emergency department. So this creates challenges for hospitals because there isn't opportunity to provide a warning or a pre-alert to allow a receiving trauma team prepare for the arrival of a child who is severely injured. And paediatric trauma as a proportion of all trauma is actually relatively small. It's about 5% of all major trauma that presents across the country. So this means hospitals don't see this type of presentation or patient as often and therefore have to compensate for this by ensuring staff are rehearsed and equipped for an unannounced arrival of a severely injured child. And that goes for every hospital that has an emergency department sign over its door. So some of these hospitals don't have emergency medicine on call consultants or trauma and orthopaedic services on site. And so bringing children to these sites can delay their definitive treatment.
Do children recover well from major trauma?
So, I mean, part of certainly the sudden nature of major trauma means families are literally thrown into a tailspin. We're very aware of the impact these incidents have on not just the patient, the child, but also their family and social network. Children who survive live on with the effects of their injuries. So we need to get it right. We need to ensure their treatment and their rehabilitation is the best it can be. This report tells us that the majority of children have to be moved on from one hospital to another for definitive care and that there is a lack of comprehensive rehabilitation for those who survive. But there is a plan. The Minister for Health in February 2018 published a trauma system for Ireland and that provides a blueprint for how trauma care should be optimally delivered.
And we'll be talking later about the National Children's Hospital and concerns over its progress. What do you think?
Well, certainly the National Children's Hospital will be an excellent major trauma centre for the children of our state. It's detailed that that is the role it will assume in the plan that's published by the Minister for Health. That was published in February 2018. Today's major trauma audit report provides important information that will help further design and refine the system insofar as it relates to children. So we make sure that those children of our state who are unfortunate enough to sustain major trauma get the best chance of survival and the best quality of survival possible.
Professor Conor Deasy, thank you for speaking to us this morning.
A shift away from the UK as a destination for European job seekers post-Brexit is manifesting in increased interest in certain categories of Irish jobs. This is according to research from the recruitment company Indeed. It shows growing interest among EU-based job seekers in areas including communications, social science and pharmacy. The UK has seen its total share of cross-border searches from the EU falling sharply. KBC has announced changes at the top of its Irish operations. Current CEO Peter Robin is to move to head up the bank's Bulgarian operations. He's to be replaced here by Aleš Blažek, who's currently head of data and strategy at the Czech Republic business unit of the KBC Group. The Eurogroup of Finance Ministers has given the green light to governments to keep spending to counteract the effects of the COVID pandemic. Debt and deficit rules were temporarily suspended last year to give member states space to support their economies. Finance Minister Pascal Donohue, who's Eurogroup president, said the focus of fiscal measures should gradually shift as the health situation improves. Currencies, the euro is trading at $1.192 and 86.2 pence sterling.
And Darren Frell's here with the sports news. Morning, Darren.
Good morning to you, Gavin. Well, Liverpool got another big win for them last night. 1-0 victors against Wolves in the Premier League. Diogo Jota, former Wolves player, of course, scored the only goal of the game there. Liverpool up to sixth and just getting an edging closer to that top four, which they need to get back to. Wolves keeper Rui Patricio suffered what looked like pretty bad head injury, but we're hearing this morning that he is okay. He was down for quite a lengthy period getting treatment. For Jurgen Klopp, the Liverpool manager, though, some games are just all about getting the 3 points.
Oh yes, it's all about the result. So it was a big fight, and if we won like 3 dirty points, completely fine with that. That's how you have to try to get back on track. So we got the 3 points and everything is fine.
Yeah, 3 dirty points. You can't beat it. There are 2 more places in the quarterfinals of the Champions League up for grabs tonight. Manchester City, 2-0 lead over Borussia Mönchengladbach from the first leg. That game live on RT2. And Real Madrid hold a 1-0 advantage over Atalanta in their meeting in Madrid. 8 o'clock start in both matches. Now, the Cheltenham Festival gets away later today. Racing begins at 1:20. Number of eye-catching races throughout the afternoon. The feature, the Champions Hurdle at 3:05. Particular Irish interest in that one. But this year's festival will take place without spectators because of COVID-19, and it means an utterly different festival. Racing journalist Don McLean joins me on the line. How different will it be, Don, there today?
Hiya, Darren. Yeah, no, it's been a strange build-up, hasn't it, to the Cheltenham Festival. We haven't had the stable visits or the pre-Cheltenham evenings that we usually have over the course of the last few weeks. And as you say, nobody's going. That's the strangest thing. So there'll be no Cheltenham roar. There'll be a really quiet atmosphere all week. But look, it's great that racing's going ahead, albeit behind closed doors. And as you say, it looks like the actual racing is probably going to be as good as ever.
Yeah, there is that cloud hanging over horse racing at the moment. We've had the Gordon Elliott stuff. How important is it that the racing goes back to centre page again, and that
it's time for the weather forecast next. Liz Walsh is standing by at Met Erin. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning. Well, it's been a bit of a dull and misty start to today, with some residual drizzle still around from last night. But conditions do look set to improve later this morning, with dry and sunny conditions extending from the north to all parts this afternoon. It's going to feel pleasantly mild in the sunshine for most of us this afternoon, with maximum temperatures ranging 13 to 16 degrees generally, mildest near that south coast. But a cool onshore northwest breeze will cap temperatures at 10 to 12 degrees in parts of the north and northwest today. It's then going to be turning cold tonight under the largely clear skies, and some mist and fog patches will form in the near calm conditions. Minimum temperatures will be down to around 0 to plus 3 degrees with a touch of frost. So there could be a few dense fog patches around at first tomorrow, Wednesday, but any frost and fog will soon clear through the morning, giving way to a largely dry St. Patrick's Day. Plenty of sunny spells on offer. Cloud is expected to advance into western and northern counties later in the day, though, with some patchy drizzle possible up there. Maximum temperatures for tomorrow will range 11 to 16 degrees again, mildest in South Munster and South Leinster in light northwest or variable breezes. And the high pressure is going to stick around for the rest of the week and on into this weekend. So our weather will be generally quiet and benign with light winds. However, it does look as though the rest of the week and the weekend will be quite cloudy overall, and this will push the daytime temperatures back down towards normal for the time of year in the region of 10 to 12 or maybe 13 degrees. But the nights will be relatively frost-free due to the increased cloud cover, and it won't be completely dry though, as there will be some patchy drizzle about from time to time, but accumulations will be fairly minimal all the same. Recapping for today, residual cloud, drizzle and mist from overnight will clear southwards later this morning. Dry and sunny conditions will extend nationwide this afternoon. Highs of 11 to 16 degrees. That's your forecast. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings and Rachel English. With the news in detail next, here's Brian Jennings.
The European Medicines Agency Safety Committee will meet today to discuss the issues around reports of some cases of blood clotting and the AstraZeneca vaccine. However, it's not expected to issue a recommendation until after another meeting on Thursday. Last night, immunisation experts here expressed hope that the pause on the use of the vaccine would be short. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
Last Sunday, the use of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine was paused here, and since then, the number of countries which have taken the same decision has increased. It follows reports of blood clots in four patients in Norway who had received the vaccine. The European Medicines Agency has insisted that the benefits of the AstraZeneca vaccine outweigh the risks of side effects. The pause on the use of the vaccine here has delayed plans this week to vaccinate 30,000 people who are frontline health staff or those at very high risk due to their medical conditions. The EMA Safety Committee will discuss the issue today, but a final decision is not expected until it holds an extraordinary meeting on Thursday.
Gardaí say they'll have a significant policing operation in place to deal with protests in Dublin city centre tomorrow, St Patrick's Day. More than 2,500 Gardaí will be on duty at key locations and checkpoints in the capital. They'll also carry out checks on public transport. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
Gardaí say they've planned a major policing operation for St Patrick's Day to prevent a recurrence of the violent scenes in Dublin city centre 2.5 weeks ago. Over 2,500 Gardaí will be on duty from regular and specialist units, including the air support, dog, mounted and public order units. Checkpoints will be placed on arterial routes into the city, and there will be high visibility patrols at public amenities as well as Garda checks on public transport. Cordons and restrictions will be in place around the city to restrict movement, and people are being asked not to attend demonstrations but to stay at home. Gardaí say they're aware of multiple protests being planned on social media by disparate groups in different locations in Dublin. They say they seek to engage with protest groups in advance, but some groups choose not to engage with them. Any policing action, they say, will be part of a graduated response to an evolving situation where they'll seek to engage and encourage before resorting to enforcement.
Facebook has reached a 3-year deal with News Corporation to pay for the news it produces in Australia. It comes just weeks after Australia passed a law aimed at making online platforms pay for news content. The deal will give Facebook access to about 70% of newspapers owned by News Corporation, as well as Sky News Australia. News Corporation, whose chief executive is Rupert Murdoch, has not disclosed the value of the deal. The Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, Michael McGrath, has expressed concern over the progress of the National Children's Hospital project to the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly. Mr McGrath's disquiet is set out in a letter to his Cabinet colleague last month, obtained by this programme under the Freedom of Information Act. The Sinn Féin leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, is seeking an urgent meeting with the Taoiseach Micheál Martin regarding her call for the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar to be sacked over his disclosure of a confidential draft of a GP contract. The Taoiseach said yesterday,
"The European Medicines Agency is reviewing safety information on the AstraZeneca vaccine and will meet on Thursday to issue a recommendation. A number of countries, including Ireland, the Netherlands, France, Germany and Italy, have suspended use of the COVID vaccine following concerns about blood clots. Up until last Friday, 124,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine had been administered here, many of them to healthcare workers. The inoculation of older people who receive different vaccines is scheduled to continue. We can talk now to Dr. Ray Wally, who's a Dublin GP and a member of the National COVID-19 GP Liaison Committee. Good morning and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Rachel.
We know that the vaccination programme for older people hasn't been without problems. What's the situation this week?
The situation this week is that the GPs and the HSC have engaged reviewed what has been happening over the last 2 weeks. And we prioritised to ensure that all of our over 85s are vaccinated for the second dose. and that the over 80s will receive the first dose, such that at the moment there's 130,000 people who have been vaccinated, and there will be another 58,000 vaccinated this week. The other thing that has happened is that with the engagement of the HSE, we're trying to reduce the amount of GP inputs into rationalising the vaccine to ensure that a lot of it is done in the back office by the HSE, and that we get improved notification on defined lists of who we will be vaccinating, to ensure that we are literally going down by age groups and cohorts nationally and not leaving anybody behind.
So should that mean then that fewer GPs are in a position where they have to ring people to cancel their vaccination appointment?
We would hope that that will be the output of this, that it'll be a more structured, rationalised system. Like, there will be some people, unfortunately, who will be disappointed. But I'll give you an example. I had four people who were in hospital who were over 85. So I was vaccinating patients, realised they couldn't get to the surgery. Some of this happened the day before and on the day. So as a result of that, we move people from the next age group in. But what we're trying to do is make sure that nobody gets forgotten. So as a result of all of that, we're ensuring that patients in hospital, if they are well enough to get vaccinated, will be vaccinated in hospital. If they're not vaccinated in hospital, we will catch up with them. Those who are vaccinated in hospital will then and have notification to the GP such that a second dose will be done. We've also now organising with the National Ambulance Service that patients who can't get the surgery, of which there's very few, there's approximately 1,800 in the whole country, and they're being vaccinated in-house by the National Ambulance Service or brought to a centre where they can be vaccinated. And I gather about 250 to 300 of those people have been vaccinated. And these, I believe, are the teething problems that you would have learning from it, listening from the GPs and listening to the HSE, because there are massive operational on logistical issues with moving the Pfizer vaccine.
Is it fair to say, though, that because of some issues with the Moderna vaccine in particular, that some patients are likely to lose out in the coming days, that they're going to have to wait longer than they'd expected to?
Yes, there's a slight reduction in that. But the people who are due the second dose will be vaccinated on time. Possibly people who are thinking they would get a Moderna first vaccine may be replaced by a Pfizer vaccine. But the whole system is meant to be working on the basis of giving it to those who are at most risk, which unfortunately it works literally on the basis of age. Those at older age are the ones who unfortunately were most greatly affected by this virus. And what we're trying to do is be equitable in moving down the age groups.
Right. But just to be clear about this, the priority will be a second dose for the 85 and overs rather than giving a first dose, say, to somebody who's in their late 70s.
Yes. And with the Moderna, to ensure the people who got the first dose will get the second dose.
I know that the plan had been for everybody in the over 70s age group to be fully vaccinated, that is, to have had two injections by the middle of May. Is that still likely, do you think?
The HSE, having tabulated the delivery of vaccine, have indicated that they believed that we were still on target to do mid-May vaccinations. AstraZeneca vaccine was not going to be one of the vaccines we were going to be giving to this group of population. So the delivery of Pfizer on Moderna should be sufficient to ensure that we can continue with a target of mid-May.
Right, so that should still be possible as far as you're concerned.
Yes.
Can I ask you, as you mentioned it, for your views on the AstraZeneca situation? Because it's clear that its suspension has disappointed a considerable number of people, especially people with chronic illnesses, with serious illnesses, who'd expected that in the coming days they would receive that first injection.
It is very disappointing. However, you know, we all, sort of unfortunately, we all eat and sleep COVID these days, and we would have all been aware of the reports in the media internationally in Scandinavian countries and other countries. So the decision was made late on Saturday night, Sunday morning. General practice liaison personnel were contacted early on Sunday morning to talk to Colm Henry. And we wholeheartedly supported the temporary deferral because we see it as a precautionary safety alert. If this was not to occur, difficulty for us in general practice is like we're obviously dealing with non-COVID work, we're dealing with COVID work, and now we're dealing with vaccinations. And the problem is all time on the phone is time consuming. However, we do want people who are sick to ring in. But if we're then having to deal with clarifying what is happening, that would have not helped. Now, that's obviously not the reason why a decision was made to make a temporary deferral, but we do see it as a precautionary safety alert. Like 11 million of these doses have been given of Astra in the UK, 5 million or so in Europe. Having been an NHS GP for a number of years, 7 years myself, I'm only too aware of the robust systems in place to pick up difficulties with interactions. So, I am optimistic that the European Medicines Authority will decide in a positive manner at the end of the week, but they have access to the data, we don't, and it's very important that we maintain confidence in the programme. As you say, a significant number of people who have had the AstraZeneca vaccine have been healthcare workers. So we among everybody else, are waiting to see what is the story with this, but we're equally aware that thrombosis is something which unfortunately can occur due to many, many different reasons. So we are willing to wait. We're delighted that, a difficult decision was made. We see it as a temporary deferral on the basis of a precautionary safety alert. And I think the right decision was made.
Have GPs been receiving many queries from people about the AstraZeneca vaccine? I'm thinking in particular maybe of people who've received that vaccine in recent weeks and who perhaps have a history of blood clots.
In liaising with a number of GPs yesterday, basically we had very few interactions. And I think that is because there has been such a big debate on this in the media. It's been covered in the social media. It's been covered in the national media. And it's very evident. It's been part of that press conference yesterday. Difficult questions were asked and difficult questions were answered. It's been a very transparent approach. And a lot of people are unfortunately learning that when you get on a long-haul flight, you can get a thrombosis, a clot. When you go for hip operations, you have the risk of pelvic operations, total hip replacements, any of those type of surgery. You have a history of potential clots. There are many, many different reasons, including inactivity. You have a history of potential clots. So the problem with this type of difficulty is they can occur in the natural phenomena anyway. I remember reading the review of one of the vaccines, and it was noted that something happened, but it was also noted that in a general population, you would have this amount of that, and it turned out when the vaccine was looked at that it was less of this event than you would normally see. So you have things like that reviewed. It is a very thorough review. You're now having many different agencies reviewing it, but I would be optimistic that by the end of the week, we will hopefully see it as a precautionary safety alert that was appropriate at the time. And I would hope that we will be vaccinating AstraZeneca vaccine in the next week or so, because we are dealing with a disease which is highly infectious, which also causes clots.
As you mentioned, that despite more than 10 weeks of restrictions, I think we'll be heading towards 11 weeks later on this week, the number of infections remains incredibly high. Why do you think that is?
Well, to a certain extent, we're emulating what happened last July and last November. We were on the way down. We plateaued. And to a certain extent, we're 1 year into this now. Not only are the medical staff exhausted and the nursing staff exhausted, any healthcare workers, the population are exhausted. We all have family. We understand what is happening. And what we are seeing is that we have done incredibly well as a society. But, we are now seeing, there is a plateau, there's a slight blip. It is the same reasons why this blip is occurring. What has happened is that people have become comfortable with the situation and our guard has been dropped. And it's the same potential congregating and not doing the simple basic tasks which are causing the infection again.
Have you noticed an increase in the number of referrals over the past 10 days or so?
I work in North Dublin, and again, in liaising with North Dublin GPs, there has been an increase in referrals. The data that we receive nationally is reflective of what is happening on the ground. General practice, to some extent, is a canary in the mine, so we see it earlier. But what we are seeing is that younger people are congregating, younger people basically are unfortunately starting to bring the infection home to the older people. So that's the big concerning thing here, is that not only are younger people getting infected, but now older people are being referred. Indeed, I'm aware of one practice yesterday that had 15 referrals for two GPs, and that's a significant number considering that the week before there may be only one or two. So, but this is something which is happening. And you can see it in the data in different areas. Certainly in North Dublin, the levels have been at the order of about 300 per 100,000. So we need to refocus where we are in all of this. We can do this. We need to bring it down. We need to watch what's happening in Europe. There is a great incentive for us to bring this down, and we can do it.
It's a year, as you say, since the true threat from this virus became apparent. Do you get a sense that at this stage, many people are just worn out from all of this? I mean, in terms of the contacts you have as a GP, you're probably in a better position than many of us to monitor people's mood. Do you get a sense that at this stage, you know, there are a lot of people who are just sick, sore and tired?
People are fed up. Their lives have totally been changed. A lot of people have become isolated, but you know, the greater majority of people, though, will say to you, you know, you need to be keeping saying the same message, and we can do this. And we have come from being the highest in Europe to now we're lower down the ratings, but we need to continue. And the greater majority of people will say they want us to do this. You know, so it literally, we've got to understand the danger of congregating indoors. We've got to understand how a mask can protect you, how washing your hands can protect you, how good ventilation can protect you, how ensuring that if you have broke the rules that you basically stay away from your nearest and dearest. We do need to adopt, in the same way we do in the general practice setting, a buddy system whereby you watch over each other. And it's not to be destructively critical when you get it wrong. It's to be constructive, because it could save lives. Like, you know, I'm afraid when we work in a hub or go to see somebody who is very sick, we'll put on the appropriate PPE and we'll look at each other to see, is there any opening there? Now, obviously, the ordinary layperson isn't going to be wearing PPE, but the simple measures of keeping your distance, wearing a mask, good ventilation, washing your hands. And another point that is happening at the moment is, again, people are delaying coming to the general practitioner. They're getting some upper respiratory tracts and symptoms, like a runny nose, like a basic cough, like, you know, sort of minimal symptoms, and they believe it's their yearly cold or whatever. At the moment, what we realize is that with this variant, that you can get minimal respiratory symptoms as a presentation. So if you are ill in any way, you need to assume COVID and you need to isolate early and you need to contact your general practitioner immediately.
Dr. Ray Wally, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Now, as we've been hearing, Gardaí say they will have a significant policing operation in place to deal with protests in Dublin city centre tomorrow. Over 2,500 Gardaí will be on duty at key locations and checkpoints nationwide and will also carry out checks on public transport. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds has more. Paul, what are Gardaí expecting?
Well, the background to this is the violent scenes which took place in Dublin city centre 2.5 weeks ago, Gavin. We know that missiles and fireworks were thrown at the Gardaí during the anti-vax, anti-mask and lockdown protest on Grafton Street. 3 Gardaí were injured, 24 people were arrested, most have been charged, they're currently before the courts. So there was a substantial policing operation put in place for another protest in Cork a week later. That passed off peacefully and the Gardaí are hoping for the same. I mean, they have been monitoring social media and they say they're aware that multiple protests and large gatherings are being planned by disparate groups in different locations in Dublin tomorrow, such as the city centre at the GPO and the Spire, government buildings, Herbert Park on the south side is also another location, and outside RTE. These are so-called hotspots. They have been the focus of much anger and resentment from anti-lockdown protesters over the past year. Now, the Gardaí also say they've no role in licensing or approving protests, and they're seeking to engage with protest groups in advance, but some groups in particular are choosing not to engage with them.
So what's in the plan?
Well, St. Patrick's Day, at any one time, they say more than 2,500 Gardaí will be on duty all over the country, uniformed, plain clothes, as well as the specialist units. The air support will monitor protests or gatherings from the air. The mounted unit, the horses, the dogs, and the public order unit will be on duty. There'll be about 66 public order unit officers. There'll be checkpoints focused on road safety violations, non-essential travel, people exercising outside their home. These checkpoints will be on arterial routes into the city to prevent large numbers of people coming into the city. High visibility patrols will be on duty at public amenities, beaches, forests, parks, beauty spots. They say they'll be managing any large gatherings that could occur there. People can expect to be stopped, the Gardaí say, and asked why they're out. Is their journey essential? Are they more than 5 kilometres from their home? Cordons and restrictions will be in place around Dublin city centre to restrict movement, and people are being asked not to organise or attend any demonstrations or protests. Now, the Gardaí say their approach will be the 4 E's approach. They will engage, explain and encourage. Enforcement, they say, will be a last resort. They also say that any Garda activity will be part of a graduated policing response to evolving events, and these will also take into account public health regulations and advice. But they are stressing that restrictions on movement don't apply to vulnerable people, those in danger, victims of domestic abuse, or indeed any crime. They say they'll always be available to people who are in these situations to provide support for them.
That's outdoors mostly, Paul. What are police, or Gardaí rather, saying in relation to house parties?
Yeah, they're worried about house parties. I mean, not just in houses, but in gardens or in residential areas, street parties. They're worried about the potential for that. I mean, the Gardaí, not just the Gardaí, the government and the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Ronan Glynn, have all asked people to stay at home and not to organise or attend any house parties or large gatherings. The Gardaí say they'll focus on these events, and there has been already a focus on parties. They say over 2,100 people have already been fined. Over 400 have been fined more than €500 for organising a house party. More than 1,600 others have been fined €150 for attending a house party. The government is also asking people not to assemble in large groups. They say that while the right to freedom of assembly is a fundamental part of our democracy, that right, they say, must be balanced against the other rights of citizens, including the protection of their health and their lives.
Paul, thank you. That's our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
Here again with the business headlines is Brian Finn.
Rachel, thank you. KBC Bank Ireland has announced a new CEO for the group here. It's to be Aleš Blažek, who's moving from the Czech Republic business unit of the KBC Group. The current CEO here, Peter Robbins, is moving to head up the bank's Bulgarian operations. Drinks Group C&C is to sell its US subsidiary Vermont Hard Cider Company to Northeast Kingdom Drink Group in a deal worth $20 million. The proceeds of the deal will go towards reducing debt. The group said it's targeting savings of €18 million a year against its pre-COVID-19 cost base. Green lending rose to almost €1.5 billion at AIB last year, an increase of around a fifth on the previous year. Among other products, banks offer so-called green mortgages, which have lower interest rates on homes that reach particular energy rating thresholds. Green lending accounted for 16% of new lending at AIB last year. Currencies this morning, the euro is trading at $1.19.3 and 86.2 pence sterling.
And with the sport, here's Darren Frahill.
Big day for the racing fans, Rachel. The Cheltenham Festival gets underway later today. There'll be 28 races across the 4-day event. And as always, there's a huge Irish interest. But as we know this time around, it's going to look and feel very different. Let's go live to the course. Rupert Bell is standing by. How different is it there this morning, Rupert?
It's extraordinarily different. Normally this will be hustle, bustle, everything getting ready for the unexpected 60,000 crowd, but I walked in and it's like a ghost town. However, there are some aspects of the festival that will never change. Suddenly there was a cavalry charge of horses just walking down the avenue, and that was the Willie Mullins battalion were going out for their early morning stretch under the foothills of Cleve Hill. So that at least felt normal, and there was smiles on the faces of all the people riding the horses, just happy to be here and be able to take part in what hopefully will be a fantastic week on the course, because that's what we need more than anything for the sport, that the racing does the talking. And to see the beaming Willie Mullins' team, they obviously can be expecting a pretty decent week, I would have thought, with the horses they've got here. And we're set fair. It's a cloudy morning, but the ground is soft, good to soft in places. So in terms of conditions, it's perfect. It's just surreal.
Rupert, what are the highlights today for you?
Well, obviously, the champion hurdle is going to be extraordinary, I think. Honeysuckle with Rachel Blackmore on board, going to be the favourite. What, as the opener said, stepping up to Champions League level now. Epitant, the defending champion who blotted her copybook at Christmas at Kempton. And then Goshen, a horse who tipped up in the Triumph Hurdle at the last flight, and would be an emotional story if that would. That will be fantastic, but we've got to appreciate it in the first, for Ireland could get off to a flying start with that horse who's been so brilliant this season. And Shishkin, from the domestic point of view, looks to be a horse of rare potential in the album photo colours, but trained by Nicky Henderson. So in terms of equine highlights, I think we're going to be in for a real treat. It's just we'll miss the roar.
Absolutely. Rupert will be with us throughout the week here on Morning Ireland. All that action coming up a little bit later on. Liverpool 1-0 winners against Wolves in the Premier League last night. Two more places in the quarterfinals of the Champions League up for grabs tonight. Manchester City have a 2-0 lead over Borussia Mönchengladbach from the first leg, and that's the live game on RTE2 this evening. Our commentator George Hamilton joins me on the line. George, are they pretty much home and hosed in this one? Can you see any issues for them?
Well, it should be a walk in the park for Manchester City. Apart from that Manchester United win at the Etihad, it's what now? It's 23 of their last 24 they've won in all competitions, including the 2-0 win over Gladbach in the first leg in Budapest. By the way, to go easier in the vocal cords, German football fans refer to Borussia Mönchengladbach as simply Gladbach. But they are in a bad place at the moment. They've got a terrible run, and their manager has been announced is leaving at the end of the season to go to Borussia Dortmund. They're in free fall in the Bundesliga. They've fallen into the bottom half. They're 2-0 down in this on a neutral venue, which is supposedly the away game anyway. So it should be straightforward for City tonight.
In terms of City, they're gathering so much momentum at the moment. They have always come up short in the Champions League, even despite having a great team. Is there a feeling this is finally their year, maybe, George?
Well, it's interesting, you know, that Guardiola saying to his team that this is the worst City team of his 5 years in charge is a way of reminding them that they've won nothing yet. But no one in this team has ever won all three domestic trophies and the elite European competition as well in the same season. And they are heading in the right direction. There's no question about that. And they've come up short in the Champions League because of a ropey defence. Three goals against Lyon last year. The previous year, they conceded three against Tottenham and went out at the Etihad. They let in five over two legs against Liverpool in 2018. So letting in goals has been the Achilles heel of Guardiola's time at Manchester City. But in the group stage this season, they conceded only once on the opening night to Luis Diaz of Porto. And here they are facing their eighth start, and there's still only that one goal conceded. So they've sorted the defence. They're up against a team that they're going to swat away tonight, in my view. And I think they're in a very, very good place for the Champions League this season.
Okay, George, have a good one tonight. Manchester City against Gladbach at 8 o'clock. I like that. Makes things an awful lot easier. And also the other game tonight is Real Madrid and Atalanta. Madrid holding a one-goal lead in that one. Now, the League of Ireland season begins at the weekend. And ahead of that, Sligo Rovers manager Liam Buckley has raised some issues and questions about how the management team are operating at Dundalk. The sides meet on Saturday. Shane Keegan is the new manager, and last season's manager, Filippo Giovannoli, is part of a coaching committee.
I've done my pro licence many moons ago, and I think there's upwards of 100 pro licence coaches around the country. And we have an obligation to make sure that every one of them are treated with great respect. So it's up to the powers to be to make sure that everything is upheld from that end of it. The rules are in place for a reason at this minute in time. I wouldn't be looking to change anything. They just need to be respected. That's all. That's what I'm basically saying. I don't know whether anybody's breaking rules or not breaking rules. Yeah. Listen, with great respect to Giovanni, okay, he's had a fantastic season last year. He's won the Cup, which is an achievement. He's qualified for Europe. He's made the group stage with achievement. He's finished third in the league. They're doing it whatever way they do. They have a committee of people picking the team. They've got two people picking the team or three, depending on what you read.
Yeah, that is Liam Buckley speaking with John Kenny there. Shane Keegan has his pro license. Filippo Giovagnoli doesn't. Let's see what happens over the course of the next few weeks with that. Interesting piece in the Irish Times this morning. The future of the Lions Tour will be decided within the next week. The Lions due to go to South Africa this summer. But if it's played as a home series for the Lions, it's unlikely Ireland will stage any game because of the COVID restrictions. As things stand, no crowds would be allowed to attend, and that would mean that the matches, all those series and tests, those tests in the series would take place in the UK. Finally, the Irish hockey team back in action this afternoon as they meet Great Britain in the third and deciding game in the Soft Coast Series. GB won the opener. Ireland, though, came back with that brilliant win on Sunday, 2-1 win there. 3 o'clock start at Queen's University, and you can watch it live on the RTE player.
Darren, thank you. It's 8:42. It's been 48 hours since it emerged the Gardaí are carrying out a full investigation into Taoiseach and Fine Gael leader Leo Varadkar's leaking of a confidential cabinet document almost 2 years ago. Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald has written to the Taoiseach and Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin to seek an urgent meeting over the issue, saying she believes Mr Varadkar needs to resign. And two Fianna Fáil TDs say they also believe the Fine Gael leader needs to temporarily step aside. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham, is here. Remind us of the background to this, Paul.
Well, the background of this is fairly simple. It was that Leo Varadkar, when he was Taoiseach, was looking at negotiations which were ongoing to try and conclude a GP contract, something which had been discussed and for many, many years. And in the course of that, he gave a confidential document to Matthew O'Toole, who was a member of a rival GP organisation, to the IMO, which the government was negotiating with. It has to be said that Dr O'Toole was also someone who Leo Varadkar knew. So the sending of a confidential document by Leo Varadkar to Dr O'Toole then emerged in the Village magazine, and since then we've had this controversy which has culminated in the fact that the Gardaí are now going to investigate the circumstances surrounding the handing over of the document, and that's where we currently stand. The Gardaí will do their investigation. They will pass on a file to the Director of Public Prosecutions, who ultimately will determine whether or not anything should happen on foot of that investigation.
So what's happening now?
What's happening now is that with the confirmation that the Gardaí have not just assessing things but actually launched an investigation, it triggered Sinn Féin to lead a full frontal attack on both the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, and the other coalition parties, in which they said that Leo Varadkar has engaged in abuse of power, and on that basis he should resign, and if he should not resign, then the Taoiseach Micheál Martin should act and should remove him from cabinet. It wasn't just the Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald who was saying this, it was also senior members of her front bench like David Cullinan as well. The response from Fianna Fáil to this latest thing which came out last night, that she wanted to have, Mary Lou MacDonald wanted to have a meeting with the Taoiseach, is silence. We don't know what the Taoiseach intends to do on that. It has to be said, it is St. Patrick's Day, it's a particularly busy time with multiple TV interviews and engagements, so maybe that might take a little bit of time to come out. When it comes to Fine Gael, however, Fine Gael sources are saying that Sinn Féin at this particular point is engaging in, and this is their words, blatant politicking and hypocrisy, in which they're seeking to score points. They're saying Deputy MacDonald doesn't care that the Dáil voted confidence in the Taoiseach last year. That was a no confidence motion put down by Sinn Féin, which the government won. And as Peter Burke says yesterday, the legal advice to the Taoiseach is that he's committed no offence and looks forward to the matter being concluded, and they're not going to be lectured by anyone in Sinn Féin. So you're getting a sense of a bubbling up of resentment within Fine Gael at the matter, in which, whatever about issuing a statement yesterday at lunchtime, that this is still a running issue today.
Could the government fall over this, Paul, or will Leo Varadkar resign?
I think both of those scenarios are highly unlikely. Leo Varadkar has shown no indication that he intends to resign. While he has apologised for errors of judgment, and that was in the Dáil last November, the Dáil voted support in him, and both his coalition partners are standing by that and reaffirmed that yesterday. With regard to the government falling, no, once again, I don't see any particular chink in the armour there. The coalition government still has the numbers there. It has to be said that the Fianna Fáil TD for Sligo Leitrim, Mark McSharry, has indicated that he believes that Leo Varadkar should stand aside temporarily until the conclusion of the Garda investigation. He has had support from Fianna Fáil's youth wing. But apart from that, there hasn't been any sign that their numbers would crumble away so much that the coalition would be in danger. So I don't think Leo Varadkar is going to resign, and I don't think the coalition is going to fall on this one.
Paul, thank you. That's our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham.
The Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform has written to the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, to express his concern about progress at the National Children's Hospital. In a letter written last month, which has been obtained by Morning Ireland through a Freedom of Information request, Michael McGrath pointed out that the government had been waiting since July of last year for a definitive update on the project from the Department of Health. He also raised concerns about the number of vacancies on the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board. Our reporter Angus Cox has the story. Angus, tell us about the concerns outlined in this letter.
This letter, Rachel, was sent by the Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, Michael McGrath, to Health Minister Stephen Donnelly on the 4th of February this year, and it highlights considerable concern within government over the Children's Hospital project. Firstly, Minister McGrath points out that since last July, as you say, the government has been waiting for a definitive update on the project from the Department of Health and the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board, which is responsible for overseeing the building of the new hospital. He says the lack of such an update gives cause for concern, adding that an options paper, which has been in development by the board for some time, has not materialised. Michael McGrath also says an urgent update on all aspects of the project should be brought in a memorandum to government as soon as possible. In this, he says the latest estimates for the cost of the project, as well as a realistic timescale for delivery, should be included. Now, the expected completion date given for the hospital last year was 2022, but then we heard at the Public Accounts Committee last month it could be 2024. Also, the spiralling cost of the National Children's Hospital, that's been a huge issue for some time. It's expected to cost at least 1.7 billion euro and could go higher than that, well above 2 billion according to some estimates. I spoke with Orla Hegarty, who is an assistant professor at UCD's School of Architecture, Planning and Environmental Policy, about how costs might be kept down on the project.
Everybody wants it finished quickly on every side, and everybody wants to make sure that the risk is taken out of it, that people are being paid for the work they do, but that people aren't being paid more than they need to be paid. So it's at a very difficult stage, and I think when projects do get into difficulties like this, particularly when the things that were assumed at the earlier stages have changed, it's very important to sometimes to renegotiate.
Orla Hegarty there. Angus, in this letter to the Minister for Health, Michael McGrath also expresses concern about the number of vacancies on the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board. Tell us about that.
That's right, Rachel, he does. Minister McGrath highlights the recent resignation of the chair of the board, Fred Barry, who left at the end of February, and says the fact that there were 5 vacancies out of 13 positions on the board at the time of the letter is not an acceptable or sustainable position, and that these vacancies must be impacting on the ability of the board to function at the required level and should be addressed urgently. Now, 2 of those positions have been filled since the letter, and there are currently 3 vacant positions on the board. In relation to this, I was speaking with Catherine Murphy, Social Democrats co-leader and a member of the Public Accounts Committee, about the importance of the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board having a full complement.
This is already a gigantically costly project. Trying to keep those enormous numbers down is of incredible importance. The fact that the board is not up to its full complement ought to be a major source of concern, because we need those control mechanisms to make sure that, claims that come in that need to be contested are contested, and that the cost of this hospital doesn't escalate further. The board has got to be brought up to strength. They have to contest claims that are not valid claims, and they have got to do that robustly.
Catherine Murphy. Has the Department of Health, Angus, has it said anything in relation to this issue of vacancies on the board?
It has. The department says the immediate priority for the minister is finding a permanent replacement for the previous chair, Fred Barry, who, as we heard, left last month. Officials have initiated the process to seek to appoint a new chairperson through the public appointment service. A statement that the department sent me adds that in the meantime, the vice chair, Tim Boucher Hayes, has been appointed as interim chair. And on the 23rd of February, Brian Keogh and Michael Barry were appointed to the board. This leaves three remaining board vacancies, and a panel for these appointments will be established as soon as the new chairperson is in place. As the department says, it would not be considered appropriate to appoint further members to the board in the absence of a permanent chairperson.
And any response to Michael McGrath's request for an urgent update on this project for the government?
Yes, I heard from the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board, which says it's completed a detailed analysis of the project timeline. That's currently being considered by the Department of Health, while the department itself says the minister's intention is to bring forward a memorandum for government in the coming weeks once this analysis has been reviewed. It adds that Minister Donnelly then expects to be in a position to provide an update on the project to all cabinet colleagues, including Minister McGrath and the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform. It's then expected, Rachel, once we have updated information on the timeline, on the cost of the project, that the board will appear before both the Health Committee and the Public Accounts Committee to answer more questions, but dates understandably yet to be fixed for any of those appearances.
Angus, thank you very much for that. That was Angus Cox, our reporter there.
Back to the virus and the vaccine, the one that has been suspended here and in several European countries, but it's still being given to people in the north. In fact, people over the age of 50 there can get their appointments online to get that vaccine at large centres this week. So how is the suspension being viewed in the UK, where almost 12 million people have had a dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine so far? We can speak now to Professor Martin McKee. He's Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Professor McKee, good morning.
Good morning.
How is this decision being received in Britain?
Well, I think I can say how it's being received more widely, not just in the UK, because obviously I'm talking to my colleagues across Europe all the time. The difficulty is that any suggestion of any problem with a vaccine has to be taken very seriously. But the number of cases that are being reported are well within what we would expect in a population of so far 5 million people across the continent, across the European Union, that have been vaccinated with the AstraZeneca vaccine. The situation is that regulators are always extremely cautious, because even if there's no evidence on the basis of what we know now of a risk, once it's been raised as an issue, they know that should at some stage even one case be found to be linked to the vaccine, then they're going to come under really severe criticism, and it will damage confidence in the regulatory process. So they're going to focus very much on that potential for even a tiny number of cases, while obviously it's not their, much less their concern about the number of people who will get clots as a consequence of getting COVID because they're not being vaccinated. So I think part of this reflects the sort of general climate of concern about the presentation, the need to maintain confidence in the regulatory process. And I think that can at times lead to what many of us would feel is an overreaction on the basis of the evidence we have at the minute, but a recognition of why this is happening.
The vaccine progress in the UK, by comparison with the rest of Europe, it doesn't compare. They're so much further ahead. And the statistics, for example, on the number of people who are going to hospital sick because of COVID in Britain has fallen hugely in the last few months, albeit that they had an enormous amount of people in hospital to begin with.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, we need to recognise that the vaccine isn't a magic bullet in all of this. We need to combine all of the measures that reduce transmission and also improving the treatment as well of people who do get into hospital. So it has to be a comprehensive strategy. You can't just expect that the vaccine will solve every problem. But it is very good news. The other thing is that the UK has made the decision, which many of us believe is the correct one, that if you have 100 doses of vaccine, it's better to make sure that 100 people get 80-85% protection rather than 50% get 95% protection and the other half are left unvaccinated. So they're delaying the second dose. But that said, what it does demonstrate is that there was a lot of planning, and I've been very critical of many other aspects of the UK. The testing and tracing system was really not good at all, and many other things have been grossly mishandled. But they have got the vaccination programme right by leaving it to the NHS. I think that's the crucial factor, by not contracting it out. And I think that reminds us that really a vaccination programme is extremely complicated. It's not just getting the vaccine into the country, it's getting it from the national airport into everybody's arms, and that requires very detailed planning, which they've done.
Professor Martin McKee, Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, thank you for speaking to us this morning. It's 2 minutes to 9.